And now, America's number one show on pop culture and politics. This is the Michael Medved Show.
And another great day in this greatest nation on God's green earth, and a great day to get serious about a great and perplexing and polarizing question in this country. What is the proper role of religion in American life? What does American history say about this country's founding? Is it true, as a lot of militant secularists insist, that our founders were a bunch of deists, that they were not Christians, and that they meant this nation to be profoundly and completely secular? Or is the opposite extreme true, that this country was founded by strict Bible-believing Christians who wanted to set up a specifically Christian commonwealth? There are great, great, great misunderstandings about the true history of the United States, about the true nature of the United States, and those misunderstandings lead to no end of unnecessary and sometimes really foolish conflicts in this country. We're going to try to provide a right answer, a balanced answer, an honest answer in this very special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, a broadcast which we offer under the heading, Is America a Christian Nation? That's known as the Thanksgiving hymn, or We Gather Together. People love to hear it, love to sing it every Thanksgiving. It's associated with the Pilgrims, whose founding of Plymouth Colony obviously represented one of the beginnings of the American Republic. Were the Pilgrims deists? Well, we will get to that. I want to go back to the very beginning and why this question about the true nature of the founders and of the founding and of America's history is so tortured and so important to get right. And to get this straight, let's go back to, not so distant history, just to 2004, with the re-election of President Bush. President Bush, because he was an outspoken Christian, produced all kinds of extreme reactions. And following his re-election, there was a flurry of books and articles that all warned everybody about the imminent takeover of this cherished republic by an all-powerful, implacable, theocratic conspiracy. Just to give you one example, there was a book by a New York Times correspondent, Chris Hedges, called American Fascists, The Christian Right and the War on America. And what Chris Hedges said is, all it will take is one more national crisis on the order of September 11th, for the Christian right to make a concerted drive to destroy American democracy. This movement will not stop until we are all ruled by biblical law. An authoritarian church intrudes in every aspect of our life. Women stay at home and rear children. Gays agree to be cured. Abortion is considered murder. The press and the schools promote positive, in quotes, Christian values. The federal government is gutted. War becomes our primary form of communication with the rest of the world. And recalcitrant non-believers see their flesh eviscerated at the sound of the Messiah's voice. For you Christians out there, is that exactly what you have in mind? According to Chris Hedges, who was actually a surprisingly genial guest on my radio show, it makes no sense to try to reason with the so-called Christian fascists. Quote, all debates with the Christian right, he writes, are useless because they hate the liberal, enlightened world formed by the Constitution. Is that true? Is there some major Christian conspiracy to undo the work of the founders and to undermine the Constitution? Well, scores of other recent releases from major publishers sought to arouse the nation's slumbering conscience to confront the perils of the group that was known as the American Taliban. Now, that's just an insult. Nobody ever here has called themselves the American Taliban, except for some Al-Qaeda sympathizers. The titles of these books that are supposed to warn people about the dangers of Christian takeover include the blockbuster bestseller American Theocracy, that's by Kevin Phillips, plus additional cheery volumes such as Jesus is Not a Republican, The Religious Rights War in America, and The Baptizing of America, The Religious Rights Plans for the Rest of Us, and Why the Christian Right is Wrong, and Liars for Jesus, and The Theocon, Secular America Under Siege, and The Hijacking of Jesus, and many, many, many more. Now, you look back from the perspective of the Obama era, and some of these books seem incredibly dated. People may not today believe, come on, we're not on the verge of some kind of Christian theocratic takeover. But still, there are many observers who continue to expect Christian conservatives to eventually attempt to remake America along the lines of Iran or Nazi Germany, while others actually suggest that Christian conservatives are just going to follow the genocidal path of communist China. This is unbelievable. In reviewing the Oscar-nominated documentary Jesus Camp, an awful movie, by the way, Stephen Holden of the New York Times solemnly declared, quote, "It wasn't so long ago that another puritanical youth army, Mao Zedong's Red Guards, turned the world's most populous country inside out. Nowadays, the possibility of a right-wing Christian American version of what happened in China no longer seems entirely far-fetched." Can you spell paranoia? Paul Krugman, who's yet another acclaimed commentator for the New York Times, argues that the theocrats will seize power through quiet subversion. Here's a quote. "The infiltration of the federal government by large numbers of people seeking to impose a religious agenda, which is very different from simply being people of faith, is one of the most important stories of the last 6 years." He's talking about the Bush administration, of course. "It's also a story that tends to go unreported, perhaps because journalists are afraid of sounding like conspiracy theorists. But this conspiracy is no theory," end quote. Krugman then provided a series of purportedly chilling examples, even asking his no doubt nervous readers, "Did you know that Rachel Palouse, the U.S. attorney in Minnesota, three of whose deputies recently stepped down reportedly in protest over her management style, is, according to a local news report, in the habit of quoting Bible verses in the office," end quote. Now, of course, another Midwestern attorney named Abraham Lincoln famously indulged precisely that same habit in every office he ever occupied, very much including the White House. He prominently featured scriptural citations, including "a house divided against itself cannot stand," in many of his most celebrated public utterances, though Lincoln's contemporaries found plenty of reasons to criticize or dismiss this cagey politician from Illinois. None of them ever attacked him for inappropriately inserting religious sentiments into public discourse. Why not? Because Americans of the 1860s understood and accepted the Christian values and the Christian vision that had shaped this republic in the 67 years of its initial existence. Contemporary hysterics who try to terrify the public all about the religious rights war against America base their scare stories on the widely touted lie that our founders meant to establish a secular nation, not a Christian one. Now, if nothing else, the alarmists have to judge our constitutional framers as miserable failures, since the nation they launched remains by far the most Christian and the least secular society in the developed world. Recent polling shows 73% of Americans believe in the existence of hell, 70% prefer presidential candidates who are strongly religious, and clear majorities refuse to support an atheist for the highest office. Some 80% of our fellow citizens currently identify themselves as Christian of one sort or another, so the public rightly sees America as a Christian nation, in the same sense that India is a Hindu nation and Mexico is a Catholic nation, even though those two countries, like the USA, don't provide governmental endorsement for a single official faith.
You're listening to a special history broadcast of the Michael Medved Show. Is America a Christian nation?
The Michael Medved Show.
You're listening to a special edition of The Michael Medved Show. Is America a Christian nation? And you're also listening in the background there to the music of Chester. That's the main marching tune of the American Revolution. It's based on a church hymn. More on that later. And I should say that a lot of the material that you're going to be sharing with me today is based on my own book, The 10 Big Lies About America. And that was a bestseller back in 2008, 2009. And big lie number 3 was the big lie that says the founders intended a secular, not a Christian nation. So it's pretty clear what the founders actually intended. They intended a Christian nation, but a secular government. Now, how did that happen? And how is that balance supposed to work? Well, we'll see. Talking about the present day, in keeping with widely embraced notions about the religious essence of the U.S., a September 2007 poll by the nonpartisan First Amendment Center showed that fully 55% of respondents agreed with a statement that, quote, the Constitution establishes a Christian nation. When asked about that survey in an interview with BeliefNet, John McCain, who was then running for president, responded, I would probably have to say yes, that the Constitution established the United States of America as a Christian nation. But I say that in the broadest sense. The lady that holds her lamp beside the golden door doesn't say, I only welcome Christians. We welcome the poor, the tired, the huddled masses. But when they come here, they know that they are in a nation founded on Christian principles. Despite the cautious and qualified tone of Senator McCain's remarks, enraged partisans leaped at the chance to attack him. The executive director of the National Jewish Democratic Council, an advocacy group for Democratic Party candidates, called the senator's statements repugnant, while the general counsel of the mainstream American Jewish Committee declared that, quote, to argue that America is a Christian nation puts the very character of the country at stake. So you know where they stand. Meanwhile, Charles Haynes, who is senior scholar at the Freedom Forum's First Amendment Center, made the most sweeping and the most profoundly misleading comments. Regarding the poll that provoked the McCain dust-up in the first place, Haynes noted that its results, quote, suggest that a great many people have deeply misunderstood the Constitution. The framers clearly wanted to establish a secular nation, end quote. Now, this contention isn't just confused. It isn't just unfocused. It is appallingly. It is demonstrably. It is inarguably. It is absolutely wrong. In fact, it's one of the 10 big lies about American history. Militant separationists of the past 50 years embrace this fanciful notion that they alone can discern the true intentions of the founding generation, intentions that remained miraculously hidden to all scholars, jurists, and politicians in the first century and a half of our nation's history, and not least to the founding fathers themselves. The whole chain of twisted reasoning regarding our allegedly secular heritage depends on a series of ludicrous myths and distortions that must give way to a few fundamental, but to religion haters, uncomfortable truths. Number one, the earliest settlers came to establish, not to escape, devoutly Christian societies. Number two, the founders worried about government's interference with religion far more than they did about religious influence on government. In fact, they viewed fervent religious faith as an indispensable component of any healthy society. And number three, separationist extremists, not Christian conservatives, seek the radical transformation of the nation and its institutions, overturning long-established constitutional balance in the process. Okay, one basic thing to understand from the very beginning. The people who founded this country, who came here from Great Britain, were seeking purity, not tolerance. The myth of America as a secular haven from the faith-based fanaticism of Europe rests on the widespread and erroneous assumption that the first colonists fled to the New World to escape religious persecution. We've all heard that. School children who celebrate the traditional Thanksgiving holiday learn that the pilgrims boarded the Mayflower in pursuit of the freedom to practice their faith, a pretty and politically correct spin that obscures some of the essential elements of the crucial story of the Plymouth colony. The pilgrims escaped from England in 1608, and then they found complete freedom in Holland 12 years before they set sail for their destiny in Massachusetts. They left the Netherlands not because that nation imposed too many religious restrictions, but because the Dutch, the most tolerant country in all of Europe, honored too few religious restrictions. The pluralism and the tolerance they found in Amsterdam and Leiden horrified the pilgrims. They were separatists who preferred an isolated situation in the wilderness that facilitated the building of a unified, disciplined, strictly devout religious utopia, not some wide-open haven for believers of every stripe. The pilgrims earn our admiration and even our love because of their courage and idealism, but their religious outlook hardly qualifies as broad-minded. Like the other stalwart believers who followed, they came to the New World seeking purity, not freedom. A decade after Plymouth's founding, the Puritans pursued similar purposes in establishing the Massachusetts Bay Colony. Succeeding generations, famously including President Ronald Reagan, have cherished the shipboard sermon of the leader of that settlement, the Puritan Massachusetts, John Winthrop. John Winthrop exhorted the settlers in biblical terms, quote, "For we must consider that we shall be as a city upon a hill. The eyes of all people are upon us." In addition to the warmer, fuzzier passages of this immortal exhortation, "For this end we must be knit together in this work as one man. We must entertain each other in brotherly affection," Winthrop also included words to indicate the unabashedly theocratic plans for the new colony. "When God gives a special commission, he looks to have it strictly observed in every article." That's John Winthrop speaking. In no sense did the New England pioneers intend to establish communities for each individual to follow the dictates of his own conscience or for the private promptings of the Holy Spirit. Winthrop explained, quote, "The end is to improve our lives, to do more service to the Lord, the comfort and increase of a body of Christ whereof we are members, that ourselves and posterity may be better preserved from the common corruptions of this evil world, to serve the Lord and work out our salvation under the power and purity of his holy ordinances." That's the basis under which they started Massachusetts. But what about the other colonies? Did they have some Christian intentions, or were people just coming to make a buck? Well, there were lots of people who came to make a buck, but even those people, as you will see, came to found communities and a nation that would be specifically Christian. We'll get to that story and more in this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, Is America a Christian Nation?
You're listening to a special history broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, Is America a Christian Nation? For more history shows, go to MedvedHistoryStore.com.
The Michael Medved Show.
You're listening to a special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, Is America a Christian Nation? And part of the attempt to deny America's Christian heritage has to do with this effort to say that, well, people who came to this country actually came to escape religious faith, came to escape religious persecution. But that's a complete distortion. If you look at the Mayflower Compact, if you look at John Winthrop's speech, his famous City on a Hill sermon on board his flagship in Boston Harbor just before they started out the Massachusetts Bay Colony, they came, as John Winthrop said, to serve the Lord and work out our salvation under the power and purity of his holy ordinances. And they enforce those holy ordinances, including rules of Sabbath observance, all kinds of rules of personal morality. It was also required for people to go to church and not to sleep during sermons. That can be a challenge. I mean, it can. But they were very serious about it in colonial America. Now, somebody here is going to say, well, not everywhere. What about Jamestown? Well, Jamestown, which was founded, of course, 13 years before the Pilgrims came to Plymouth, and almost a whole generation before they set up the Massachusetts Bay Colony in Boston, Jamestown was not specifically founded as a religious experiment. However, the people who started that colony were also deeply religious and felt that part of the reason they were coming to the New World was not just to get rich, but was to advance the Christian faith. For instance, at the first landing of the original Jamestown expedition, that would be April 26th, 1607. Can you imagine, more than 400 years ago? On that day, when they landed for the first time in the New World, the captain of their ship, Christopher Newport, took it upon himself to erect the colony's very first structure. It was a large cross at Cape Henry that was used to mark their arrival. Kind of expect in the scene, as they're erecting this cross in the New World, some Indian from the ACLU to jump out of the bush and say, you can't put that here. This is no. Well, that didn't happen. And the cross actually stood and was replenished and restored for many years. So what about the other colonies? All of the other New England colonies, except for Rhode Island. Rhode Island was a breakaway from Massachusetts, and was a breakaway partially, yes, for religious tolerance. Rhode Island, they welcomed religious believers of every stripe, which is one of the reasons that the oldest continual Jewish congregation in the country was founded in Newport, because they were welcomed in Rhode Island. In any event, all of the New England colonies, except for Rhode Island, carved homes out of the wilderness on the same devoutly Christian basis. They aimed to establish model religious communities that would be more rigorous and restrictive, not more open and accepting, than the corrupt, politicized Church of England that they left behind. Massachusetts, Connecticut, New Hampshire, and later Vermont and Maine strictly enforced Sabbath rules, mandated attendance at worship services, and yes, they used tax money to support religious seminaries, prominently including Harvard and Yale. All of this was befitting Christian commonwealths. If anything, the New England colonists distrusted and defied the Church of England for its backsliding and its compromises rather than its vigorous imposition of religious standards. They built remarkably successful self-governing settlements, but no one could describe their colonies as living laboratories of religious freedom. Between 1658 and 1660, in fact, Massachusetts authorities hanged four Quaker missionaries, including a woman, Mary Dyer, because they had defied repeated arrests and banishments to try to spread their heretical ideas in a society that considered those ideas unacceptably sinful. Of the original 13 colonies, 10 mentioned religious purposes in their founding documents. Even Virginia, where most of the early settlers seemed to care more about finding gold than finding God, received an initial charter from King James that described a mandate for, quote, the propagating of Christian religion to such people as yet live in darkness. Delaware's charter explicitly commands further propagation of the holy gospel. Other denominations, Quakers in Pennsylvania, Catholics in Maryland, founded their colonies not to create secular or diverse environments, but to provide denominational havens for their co-religionists. Even in the Dutch settlement of New Amsterdam, which became New York in 1665. The Director General, Peter Stuyvesant, remember him? He was the son of a minister, and he attempted to impose the dictates of his Calvinist faith, ruthlessly driving out Quakers and only reluctantly accepting one boatload of Jews. Among the original colonists, only Roger Williams' quirky Rhode Island made a consistent priority of religious tolerance. So what happened to create the First Amendment? We'll get to that and more on this special broadcast. Whatever the controversies, whatever the surprises in the world around us at the moment, it's important to get some perspective, and no better source of perspective than the history of this great country. at medvedhistorystore.com. Check out some of the titles we have on offer about the Constitution, about the origins of our tax system, about the history of third parties. Enrich your understanding and appreciation with CDs and MP3 downloads at medvedhistorystore.com. You're listening to a special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show, America's number one show on politics, pop culture, and U.S. history. This special broadcast entitled, Is America a Christian Nation? And coming up to a subheading called Fighting for Sanctity, Not Separation. Okay, those who maintain that our founding fathers fought our revolution in part to ensure separation of church and state have to somehow explain the favorite marching song of the Continental Army. Okay, the much better known Yankee Doodle became widely popular only after the Revolutionary War. But in the midst of the fighting, George Washington's men more commonly sang a song called Chester. It's an amazingly stirring 1770 hymn written by the Boston composer William Billings. Now, the lyrics, apparently written by Billings himself, placed the whole bloody conflict in a frankly religious perspective. Okay, this song goes on to note that God inspired us for the fight against the Redcoats' infernal league before concluding with a verse that says, "What grateful offering shall we bring? What shall we render to the Lord? Loud hallelujahs let us sing and praise his name on every chord." Now, the reference to his name, it's not necessarily a reference to George Washington. It's a reference to the father of the whole world, not just the country. In 2008, you may remember HBO did a superb miniseries called John Adams, and it appropriately shows John and Abigail Adams, played by Paul Giamatti and Laura Linney, singing part of this hymn in church in the early days of the struggle. And it says a great deal about the Revolutionary Army that they transformed this church hymn directly into a marching song, the most popular marching song for the American troops. John's cousin, Samuel Adams, also embraced the sentiments of the song as one of the most radical and simultaneously one of the most ardently religious of all the revolutionary leaders. His colleagues in the Continental Congress, whose name was Dr. Benjamin Rush, wrote of Sam Adams, "He considered national happiness and the public patronage of religion as inseparably connected. And so great was his regard for public worship as the means of promoting religion that he constantly attended divine service in the German church in Yorktown while the Congress sat there, although he was ignorant of the German language." Okay, this is a level of religious devotion that few people could muster. He didn't speak any German at all. But when they had to leave Philadelphia because they were driven out by the British and they went to York, Pennsylvania, Sam Adams went to the German church because it was the only one he felt comfortable going to, even though he couldn't understand.
This is the Michael Medved Show. The Michael Medved Show.
This same combination of fierce religiosity and fearless commitment to the independence cause occurred again and again and again among the American patriots. To a great extent, they represented the controversial and the impassioned religious right of their time. Those who held more moderate, tolerant, relaxed religious views or embraced the conventional mainstream Church of England more likely took their place among the Tories who supported the crown. Or else they joined that one-third of colonists, according to the famous estimate of John Adams, who remained neutral or undecided in the great struggle. The independence fighters had been disproportionately touched by the fervor of the Great Awakening, that explosion of Christian enthusiasm and revival inspired in the previous generation by visiting British evangelists such as George Whitefield and the Wesley brothers. During the Revolutionary War, fighting pastors became so numerous that the British made fun of them with reference to their dark robes as the Black Regiment. In The Light and the Glory, Peter Marshall and David Manuel tell the story of Peter Muhlenberg, the 30-year-old pastor of a German-American Lutheran church in Virginia's picturesque Shenandoah Valley, where my wife's family comes from, by the way. On a Sunday morning after the fighting had begun in Massachusetts in 1775, Reverend Muhlenberg took as the text for his sermon the celebrated line from Ecclesiastes 3:1, "For everything there is a season and a time for every matter under heaven." He concluded his presentation with a solemn prayer, then raised his voice and continued to speak. "In the language of the Holy Writ, there is a time for all things. There is a time to preach and a time to fight." He paused for maximum impact, then he shocked the congregation by throwing off his pulpit robe to reveal the freshly made uniform of a colonel in the Continental Army. "And now is the time to fight," he roared. "Roll the drums for recruits." That same afternoon, Pastor Muhlenberg marched off toward Boston at the head of a column of 300 men. Now, this regiment became the celebrated 8th Virginia, with a pastor himself reaching general's rank as commander of Washington's 1st Light Infantry Brigade. The American revolutionaries saw their battlefield and their political opponents not only as enemies of liberty, but as enemies of God himself. And they emphasized religious revival as an essential component of potential victory. Dr. John Witherspoon, who is the esteemed religious scholar and president of the College of New Jersey, which has become known more recently as Princeton University, he wrote a widely distributed 1776 pamphlet declaring that he is the best friend to American liberty who is most sincere and active in promoting true and undefiled religion, and who sets himself with the greatest firmness to bear down on profanity and immorality of every kind. Whoever is an avowed enemy of God, I scruple not to call him an enemy of his country. George Washington similarly viewed Christian commitment as an indispensable means for rallying the troops and securing the blessings of Providence. The day after he took command of the Continental Army outside of Boston in 1775, he issued a general order proclaiming that the general most earnestly requires and expects of all officers and soldiers not engaged in actual duty a punctual attendance of divine services to implore the blessings of heaven for the means used for our safety and defense. Throughout the war, Washington seemed obsessed with organizing his men in prayer and suppressing profane cursing, swearing, and drunkenness, in part by ordering regular days of fasting or Thanksgiving. So what did the ACLU of the time do about it? Actually, there was no ACLU at that time. There were people who were fighting and dying to protect real religious liberty. And what does that mean? We'll get to that and more in this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show.
Hey, this is Rockstar Greg with the Michael Medved Show. Thanks for listening to the special history broadcast. If you want even more content from Michael Medved, go to our website, michaelmedved.com, and consider becoming a Medhead. And there's so much content available. The 3-hour daily broadcast, commercial-free, hundreds of commentaries, 2 new podcasts, private chats with Michael, and lots more. It's all at michaelmedved.com. Click on the Medhead subscription and become a member. Thanks for listening in this greatest nation on God's green earth.
This is Michael Medved at michaelmedved.com for Town Hall. Today's media tend to focus on alarming news while ignoring or distorting encouraging indicators all around us. A recent development trumpeted in the New York Times with the headline "Frozen in Place" reported that Americans moved to new homes at the lowest rate on record. The Wall Street Journal also decried this trend, calling baby boomers the biggest culprits for declining to downsize and causing a sluggish housing market. Actually, a tendency to remain long-term in one home is an indication of growing stability that can contribute to the development of more meaningful community ties. In the past, sociologists fretted over American restlessness and rootlessness, with our citizens shifting to new homes twice as quickly as they do today. But this recent trend towards stability represents a positive change, and the media decision to complain about it is just another sign that we don't have a news business in America. We have a bad news business. I'm Michael Medved. You're listening to an authentic arrangement of the most popular marching tune of the American Revolution, favored by the Continental Army. It's called Chester. And as we discussed, this was an arrangement of a very popular church hymn that became this popular march. Church hymn, Chester, by William Billings, great Boston composer. He wrote it in 1770. And it shows you something, particularly in this beautiful rendition, authentic rendition, by the Fifes and Drums of Colonial Williamsburg on a CD they've produced called Echoes of Revolution. And they strive for authenticity, so do we, with our whole series of special Michael Medved history CDs, downloads, and broadcasts. If you want a copy of this particular broadcast, Is America a Christian Nation?, or any of our other history broadcasts, you should call Tree Farm Communications. That's a 1-800-468-0464, 1-800-468-0464. Or go to our website, Michael Medved, M-E-D-V as in victory, ED.com. And I should also say that a large part of this broadcast, most of it, in fact, is based on my best-selling book from 2008-2009, The 10 Big Lies About America, Combating Destructive Distortions About Our Nation. And autographed editions of that book will also be available from our website. We're speaking before about General Washington. And it was not just that his troops marched forward into battle to a marching tune that references God, New England's God, and faith and offerings to God, but he was also deeply obsessed with prayer and with religious faith as an element in victory. In 1778, he issued a typical general order, which announced, "The Commander-in-Chief directs that divine service be performed every Sunday at 11 o'clock, in each brigade which has a chaplain. While we are duly performing the duty of good soldiers, we certainly ought not to be inattentive to the higher duties of religion. To the distinguished character of a patriot, it should be our highest glory to add the more distinguished character of a Christian." That's George Washington, not in church, not in private, but as a general order, as commander-in-chief of the army. So where do people get this absurd idea that our founding fathers were allergic to religion, or that the founding fathers, including Thomas Jefferson, were really deists who didn't believe that God played an active role in human affairs, or that Thomas Paine was universally and unequivocally against religion? If he was, why did he feel that religion must be taught in public schools? We will get to all of that and go to the true reason for the First Amendment mandating a secular government in a Christian nation. That true reason was defending unity, not secularism. That and more in this special broadcast of the Michael Medved Show. Is America a Christian Nation? Essential that people recognize the facts that we are laying out here. The truth about the true history and heritage of this greatest nation on God's green earth.